Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking at a really fascinating stack of sources. They managed to connect, believe it or not, a Hollywood classic, It's a Wonderful Life, with some pretty profound moral concepts and even deep theological principles. Quite the mix.
It really is. And our mission, you could say, for this deep dive is to kind of challenge the usual definition of wealth. We're specifically digging into this idea of generosity, not just as being nice, but, well, as a deliberate investment.
Yeah.
Something that the sources argue yields a guaranteed, unique kind of return.
Right. And the central question that pops up again and again in these articles is something we all grapple with, I think. What does it actually take to become, quote, the richest man in town?
Exactly. And spoiler alert, according to these sources, it's got very little to do with how much cash you have squirreled away.
So they use the movie as the main anchor.
They do. The whole discussion revolves around George Bailey, his life, what happens in that 1946 film. They're essentially saying this story isn't just entertainment. It's maybe the best illustration out there of this principle that true wealth is built differently, more on social capital and giving things away, not hoarding them.
Okay, so let's unpack that using the film as our case study then. George Bailey, his initial dreams were all about ambition, right? Getting out of Little Bedford Falls.
Oh, completely. He had these huge plans.
Yeah.
You know, travel South America, go to college to see what they knew, as he put it, and then just see the world. Big geographical dreams.
But life had other plans, didn't it?
It really did. It's actually fascinating how systematically things went wrong for those plans. His father dies, then the depression hits. Mr. Potter's always scheming. It was just one thing after another.
Mm-hmm.
And these unexpected events basically forced him, kind of reluctantly, to stay and run the family business, the Bailey Building and Loan. He kept packing that suitcase, you know, but it just got heavier and heavier with deferred hope, really.
That reluctance, though, the sources seem to suggest it's important for the eventual payoff.
Yes, absolutely. They really zero in on the way he served. George didn't run the Building and Loan like Potter would have, or like a typical bank, maybe.
How so?
Well, he actively resisted Potter's more predatory view, the idea that you use people's poverty against them. Instead, George became this very personal banker. He was focused on helping families. The sources highlight he helped tons of low-income families buy their first homes.
So he wasn't just lending money, he was building community.
Exactly. He was depositing trust, you could say, stability, even dignity into the town's fabric. He was investing in people, not just balancing ledgers.
Hmm.
When someone needed a loan, maybe they couldn't quite make it, he'd give them advice, or just enough breathing room. He really became more than a banker. He was this trusted, loyal, generous friend to pretty much everyone.
And the sources call that his investment portfolio. Decades of doing this.
That's the language they use, yeah. This long-term investment portfolio built on relationships and goodwill.
Which brings us, inevitably, to the crisis,
yeah.
Christmas Eve.
The breaking point. His partner, good old Uncle Billy.
Oh, Uncle Billy.
Yeah. He accidentally misplaces a huge amount of cash. $8,000, which was a fortune then.
And the bank examiner picks that day to show up for an audit.
Terrible timing. Suddenly, that simple mistake, losing the cash, it threatens everything. The building alone could collapse. George could go to jail. All that social capital he built up over the years, it seemed completely worthless against this, you know, financial and legal storm.
And that's when he hits rock bottom, the despair.
Absolute despair. You see all those years of deferred dreams, the financial struggles, it all just crashes down on him in that moment. He feels like a complete failure.
Leading to the famous wish, I wish I'd never been born.
Precisely. Which, of course, triggers the intervention from Clarence. But the rescue.
Yeah.
That's where this investment concept really plays out, according to the sources.
Okay, walk us through that payoff from the perspective of these articles.
Well, the community hears he's in trouble. And these aren't just random people. They're the very people he helped over the years. The families he got out of Potter slums. The people he gave loans to.
They show up at his house?
Spontaneously. And they don't just offer thoughts and prayers. They literally open their wallets.
Yeah.
They start putting cash on the table. Dollars, coins, whatever they have. It's a tangible, immediate repayment of all that goodwill.
It's like the ultimate liquidity event, but based on relationships.
Exactly. And notice, Mr. Potter, the actual richest man in town by monetary standards, the one who hoarded everything and never invested in people. He's powerless here. He can't stop it. He can't help George, even if you wanted to, which he didn't.
While Sam Wainwright, the wealthy friend George helped years ago.
Right. Sam hears the news and wires twice the amount George needed, just like that.
So the sources conclude his real wealth wasn't money in a vault.
No. It was on the loyalty, the trust, the relationships he'd cultivated over decades. That's why Clarence famously tells him, "You really had a wonderful life," and calls him the richest man in town.
Okay, so the sources are saying this isn't just a nice movie moment, it's illustrating a principle. But how do they translate that tangible community bailout into something? Well, more guaranteed for the rest of us not living in Bedford Falls.
Right. That's the pivot. They connected directly to spiritual principles. Mm-hmm. They argue George's payoff is basically an earthly, maybe temporary example of a mechanism that's universally guaranteed. They link his generosity straight to a spiritual investment model.
This is where it gets really interesting with the ROI, the return on investment idea. The sources actually quote scripture here, don't they? Proverbs?
We do. Specifically, Proverbs 19.17, which says, "Whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deed."
Lends to the Lord. That's strong language.
It's crucial phrasing, isn't it? It reframes the whole act.
Mm-hmm.
If you give to someone in need, according to this source material, you're not just giving it away. You're engaging in a kind of secured lending.
How so? Secured how?
Well, the idea is you're moving your resources, your generosity, out of the purely human realm where, you know, an Uncle Billy can lose it or a potter can scheme against it, and you're depositing it somewhere else. Into what the sources imply is a guaranteed asset class backed by divine justice.
Okay, so the repayment isn't necessarily that pile of cash showing up on your living room table when you're in trouble.
It might be, sometimes. But the core guarantee isn't necessarily immediate, identical repayment. It's more an assurance of justice, an assurance that the act, the investment, won't be overlooked or lost.
It speaks to the security of it.
Precisely. Unlike, say, the stock market, or a business venture where things can go wrong, bad partners, market crashes, this spiritual investment, according to these sources, it cannot ultimately fail. The return is guaranteed. Even if its form or timing isn't always what we expect, it will be equitable.
That's a really high bar for generosity, though. Does the source define what kind of generosity qualifies for this lending to the Lord model?
It does, and this is where another key reference comes in Ephesians chapter 2. The sources point there to set a kind of benchmark.
What does Ephesians 2 say about it?
It describes what the sources call the absolute epitome of love and generosity. God making people alive in Christ, reconciling them to himself, even when they were, quote, dead in their sins, totally separated.
Wow, that's radical generosity. How does that apply to, you know, someone just trying to live their life? We can't operate on that scale.
Right. The source isn't saying we have to achieve divine levels, but it uses that context, God's radical unearned generosity, to define the kind of generosity that matters in this model. It should be, ideally, similarly radical in its own way. Undeserved, maybe costly, certainly profound.
So like George Bailey giving those families housing terms they couldn't get anywhere else, even though it kept them financially stressed.
Exactly. He didn't have to do that. It was a costly choice, a sacrifice. The source argues that this kind of willing sacrifice, this emulation of radical giving, even when it feels risky or inconvenient, is inherent to a healthy spiritual life. It's urging the listener towards that kind of investment.
Okay, but let's push back a bit. The sources talk about investing in others, which sounds great, but as you said, it often meant George was broke. He was constantly struggling financially because he was so generous. Does the source acknowledge that very real risk, the financial strain?
It focuses more on the, let's say, the psychological risk, which they argue is often even greater.
Or do you mean?
The sources explicitly warn against letting the disappointments of life stop you from being generous. Think about George's bitterness, his frustration when his dreams kept getting derailed, that pain. That's the real danger.
Ah, because it can make you pull back.
Exactly. It can lead to hoarding what you have, becoming suspicious, withdrawing your goodwill. Essentially adopting the posture of Mr. Potter. That bitterness is presented as the biggest obstacle to this whole investment model.
That makes a lot of sense. So the practical takeaway for you, the listener, is pretty direct then. The source literally asks, are you investing in generosity today? Are you depositing your gifts, talents, and resources into others? It really frames your life as this vehicle for either hoarding or distributing value.
Mm-hmm. And it's quick to remind us, this investment isn't just about writing checks. The sources list very practical ways to make these deposits. Simple acts of kindness, you know, offering genuine words of encouragement, sacrificing your time for someone.
Using your specific skills or talents to help out.
Yes, exactly. Using your unique gifts and resources. George Bailey's primary gift wasn't money. He rarely had any. It was his skill as a community builder, his integrity, his willingness to trust people. That was his deposit.
Okay, so thinking about the long game then, we saw the immediate bailout in Bedford Falls. But beyond that specific, almost cinematic moment, is there a broader assurance, a guarantee that your service, your sacrifices won't just be, well, overlooked or forgotten?
That's the crucial question, isn't it? What if the community doesn't rally? What if your kindness is taken advantage of? And the sources provide a very direct answer for that concern. They point to Hebrews 6.9.
And what does that verse say?
It says, "For God is not unjust, so as to overlook your work and the love that you have shown for his name in serving the saints, as you still do."
God is not unjust so as to overlook. That speaks directly to that fear of being forgotten or cheated. It's an assurance of cosmic justice, essentially.
Precisely. Your work, your love, your generosity, it's seen, it's recorded, and it will not be overlooked. The source material explicitly links the tangible recognition, George got the money on the table, the singing, the community affirmation, to this broader principle.
So even if the earthly reward seems missing, the investment itself is secure.
That's the assurance being offered. It validates the sacrifice. It tells the investor that their capital, their generosity is safe, and the ultimate return is certain, because the one guaranteeing it is just.
Bringing it all together, the final synthesis here is, while it's genuinely compelling, George Bailey becomes the richest man in town, but not by chasing wealth like Potter, not by accumulating.
No, quite the opposite. He did it by consistently distributing his time, his resources, his trust, his loyalty over decades.
And that resulted in this crisis resolution that financially went way beyond what he actually needed at that moment.
Yes. It demonstrated, in a narrative way, the superior security and, you could argue, the exponential return potential of this generosity-based investment portfolio.
It's like the movie provides the real-world example, even though it's fiction.
Of the spiritual investment model described in those verses we talked about.
Exactly.
His loan to the community, his investment in people, was repaid manifold in currencies that Potter could never touch. Safety, love, affirmation, belonging, purpose.
This was definitely a rich deep dive. We went from unpacking George Bailey's deferred dreams all the way to this really profound idea that choosing to deposit your talents, your kindness, your resources into others, even with the risks, is actually the highest form of building wealth with an assured return.
Yeah. The ultimate takeaway from these sources is pretty straightforward, but deeply challenging. Make that conscious choice. Allow generosity to make you the richest person in town. And start measuring your success differently, not by what you hold on to, but by what you purposefully give away.
So here's a final thought for you to maybe explore this week, drawing directly from what we covered. The sources specifically mention that disappointments of life can really block our ability or willingness to be generous. Think about that heavy suitcase George carried, full of deferred dreams. Maybe you have one too. Despite any recent disappointment, which one of those practical acts the sources listed, simple kindness, maybe some words of encouragement, sacrificing a bit of time, or using one of your skills, which one could you intentionally commit to this week as a deliberate investment in someone else? Go ahead, make that deposit. Thanks for diving deep with us today.